This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 23rd day of March 2011 here in Japan. And on a programming note, given the scale of the events unfolding here in Japan right now, I am ending my planned hiatus early and will be providing ongoing coverage of the crisis from today on. So please stay tuned to CorbettReport.com for that. And today I am joined on the line by Dr. Najmuddin Meshkadi, a professor of engineering at the University of Southern California who specializes in risk reduction and reliability enhancement of complex systems such as nuclear power plants. He has written and lectured extensively on such things as the causes and impacts of the Chernobyl disaster and the Tokaimura nuclear accident in 1999. Dr. Meshkadi, it's a pleasure to have you here today. Thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much, and thanks for calling me and wanting to hear my points. Thank you.
Well, tell us from your own professional experience what you've noted about the current crisis going on at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan.
Basically, what I can do is just to recap what I have been hearing and following this news very closely. Again, it's needless to say that the whole crisis started with the earthquake and then ensuing tsunami. And the tsunami, of course, hit the coast. There were two nuclear power stations, and Please accept my apology for mispronouncing them. One of them is Fukushima Daiichi, the other one is Fukushima Daiichi. And the interesting thing that I came across is the design base for the walls that they could stop the tsunami for Fukushima Daiichi plant. The design base was 6.5 meters. But they were hit by a tsunami with a wave height of the 7 meters. However, the Fukushima Daiichi plant was able to somehow withstand the tsunami, and we don't hear that much about it. The problem or the issue happened at Fukushima Daiichi when because it's at a lower elevation than the other Fukushima. Fukushima Daiichi is at a lower elevation, and that's why this tsunami waves really overwhelmed the plant's emergency diesel generator. I may like to backtrack here for one second. Is when the earthquake happened, the nuclear reactors, they shut themselves down automatically, which is based on the design. There is nothing wrong with that. And when the earthquake happens with this size and magnitude, usually we lose off-site power. And again, that's a predictable type of accident in nuclear plant. This is called loss of off-site power. That's why we have emergency diesel generators. And the emergency diesel generators also, they kicked in as they are designed to do so. So far, we didn't have any problem. But the problem started at Fukushima Daiichi plant when these emergency diesel generators that they kicked in, apparently they got overwhelmed and inundated by the tsunami water. And that's why they couldn't continue. They shut down and they switched to the backup battery power, and those battery power, they ran out after a few hours. And then the rest is history. That's where we are.
Well, in a recent Reuters article, you were quoted as saying that you were concerned that the water that they've been dumping on the reactors to cool them down is now effectively contaminated radioactive wastewater, and it's likely being dumped out to sea. And in the last 24 hours, we have heard of the results of seawater testing in the area that confirm radioactive iodine-131, cesium-134, and cesium-137 at unsafe levels. What does this mean, and what are the consequences for Japan and the rest of the world if these levels continue to rise?
That's a very important point, because once you shut down the nuclear reactors, they still have some residual heat in the reactor core. And in order to cool down the reactor and absorb that residual heat, you still need to have circulation and the cooling water going around the nuclear fuel bundles. And because of that, we need that emergency diesel generators. But unfortunately, those diesel generators couldn't work. That's why the reactor core, they couldn't get cooled. And that's why we have some partial meltdown in some of these reactor cores. and reactor pressurized vessel or reactor pressure vessel, something which is called RPV. The reactor pressure vessel on reactor number 2 got breached, and we have partial fuel damage in 3 out of 4 reactors, or 3 out of 6 reactors. And then the other problem that we faced, of course, as you know, that we had explosion of the secondary containment wall and reactor number 3 and reactor number 4, and I think again on reactor number 2, possibly, which means that there is a spent fuel pool. These spent fuel are still hot and radioactive. That's why they need circulation, and they need to sit in a pool of water with 30 feet of water above them. This water basically works as a radiation absorbent and also as a cooling mechanism. The problem is we have 2 spent fuel tools on reactor 3 and reactor 4 that they also lost circulation. And in the case of reactor 4, it's a controversy. U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission says they lost total water. However, Japanese government and TEPCO say, you know, they may still have some water. Make this story short, in order to cool down this damaged nuclear reactor cores and also this cooling pond, this spent fuel pond, they decided to pump seawater, literally the day after the accident. And when they decided to pump the seawater in the reactor core and onto this spent fuel pool, they practically made the decision that these reactors are doomed, because there is no way you can bring back a reactor that you pump seawater in them. And the question that I raised in last few days is because I have not been seeing any report whatsoever. And again, if your listeners have any report on that in the last 3 days, I will be delighted to be educated with. I have not been seeing any report by TEPCO, Japanese government, or the International Atomic Energy Agency that where does all this seawater that gets pumped to this reactor cores or this spent fuel pool in order to cool them, where do they go? Where is the runout this water is going? Because I understand that we have to pump the seawater. We don't have any choice because there will be a catastrophic meltdown or explosion of the spent fuel pool. But it would be important for us, the international community, to know where does this seawater go? Because this seawater, once coming to the plant, is clean. But once it goes to the reactor core with partial fuel bundle damage or to this radioactive spent fuel ponds, when they get out from these places, when they run off of these reactor cores, or that are radioactive water, where does this radioactive end up going to? Is it going to be, do they have a pond or something that they're storing that, or they are discharging that to Pacific Ocean? Again, I understand this is an emergency, but at the same time, I think we need to know what is the level of this water, what are the radiation level of that, what type of the isotope it contains, and what type of a modeling or study has been done in terms of its dilution and spread in the Pacific Ocean. And I think TEPCO is so preoccupied with handling the crisis. Japanese government is so busy to deal with the aftermath of a major national catastrophe. And I think it's the responsibility and the job of the International Atomic Energy Agency to do this type of thing. And unfortunately, I'm very disappointed to hear Mr. Amano, the Director General of this International Atomic Energy Agency, who said yesterday in a news conference that, quote, we are not a safety watchdog agency. And I think this is in a direct contrary to the citation of the Nobel Peace Prize, which was given in 2005 to the International Atomic Energy Agency and its director, Dr. Mohammad Arbaradei. And I shared that with my student, and I'm reading from the citation. part of the citation says they are receiving this award, they are giving that to IAEA for to, quote, ensure that nuclear energy for peaceful purposes is used in the safest possible way, unquote. This is from the Nobel Peace Prize citation of 2005. And then here yesterday, Mr. Amano comes, says, quote, we are not a nuclear safety watchdog. And he insisted that the safety is the responsibility of the member states. I think this is needs to be investigated or needs to be studied. Maybe Mr. Amano is defining a new charter for IAEA.
Indeed. Well, you raise an extremely important point there, not only about the information about where this seawater is being pumped, but also just on a general point about the information, the quality of the information that's coming out from the governmental agencies here in Japan, also with the IAEA and the UN. And it does raise the question of whether the public is getting adequate information about this crisis. And I guess the other question as a adjunct to that would be, what don't we know at this point about the crisis, and what would you like to see? What kind of information would you like to see forthcoming?
I think you're absolutely right. I've been following nuclear safety issues in Japan, as you said earlier in my introducing me. I followed nuclear safety in Japan very closely. We have a very popular website with my USC student on Tokaimura accident of September 1999. In fact, I'm very proud to say that if you go to Google and type Japan nuclear accident, our website, which is called Tokaimura parentheses Japan nuclear accident, is on the top 10 of Google among 12 million websites. And on that website, you see my students' very beautiful analytical paper questioning some studies done by the Japanese government after Tokaimura accident investigation, my student questioning IAEA's accident investigation. And then on that website, there are three articles that I wrote and published, one in 1999, one in year 2000, which were published in Japan Times. In fact, the title of the article of year 2000 in Japan Times is Japan Must Commence Nuclear Safety. Then I have a follow-up article which is on that website. It's about TEPCO and the crisis that TEPCO had, which led to the resignation of its executive in 2002. What I'm trying to say is that I've done work with Kansai Electric and the Institute of Nuclear Safety Systems in Suraga, and I've been to Mihama nuclear plant. And I have to say, really, there is a world of a difference between the safety culture of TEPCO and Kansai. And TEPCO, unfortunately, is mired in secrecy, lack of transparency. And there was a problem again with TEPCO during the earthquake of 2007 with the Kashiwazaki earthquake, that it was revealed that they were falsifying data or not showing information on that. Basically, what we are facing here, sir, is the traditional, basically, lack of transparency from TEPCO, which, by the way, is a function of the corporate safety culture. We cannot change that overnight. And then, of course, the somehow lack of openness also of the Japanese government. To some extent, this is interesting that Japanese Prime Minister, he criticized TEPCO a few days ago for lack of openness, and it's all reported in the media. In fact, I was reading a report in Los Angeles Times of some very strong language that Mr. Prime Minister used against TEPCO 3 days ago. And again, if you find that, I can forward you the New Los Angeles Times article. You can post that on your website. But basically what I'm saying here is we cannot expect TEPCO to be transparent and share information all of a sudden. It's not in their culture. It hasn't been in their culture. We cannot expect Japanese government also to do that because they are literally overwhelmed and they are relying very much on TEPCO. But the biggest tragedy is not the TEPCO or Japanese government. In my humble opinion, the biggest tragedy in this situation is what the International Atomic Energy Agency has been doing. For the last week, if you visited their website, they have been literally a conduit for the information trickled down from the Japanese government. Everything on the IAEA website was according to the report that we got from Japanese government. If I want to read the report of Japanese government, why should I go to the IAEA website? And by the way, this thing that I'm telling about IAEA is not a criticism. I think IAEA, unfortunately, is neither equipped nor capable of doing this type of work. And this is not the first time. I have said that in a testimony that I gave before the U.S. Commission to Improve the Effectiveness of United Nations in 1993. The title of my testimony, that I can email you a copy of that, you can post that on your website if you like, was the critical role of the IAEA in ensuring the safety of nuclear power plants around the world. I gave that testimony in 1993, which was basically 7 years after Chernobyl. Chernobyl happened on April 26, 1986. At that time, I said IAEA did not do a good job in case of Chernobyl. We need to beef it up. We need to beef up its safety section, which is really, its budget is minuscule when it comes and compare that to their safeguard budget. And at that time, I cried for improving and empowering and enhancing and expanding the IAEA roles and responsibility for this type of crisis. Unfortunately, my cry went unheeded. And now we are facing this situation that all this water is being dumped somewhere, most probably in the Pacific Ocean, and nobody is there to mind the shop. Nobody is there to tell the international community of what's going on. And we have an agency called the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Indeed. Well, you raise a number of very important points there, but I know that you're pressed for time. So just before we wrap things up, I guess I'd like to ask the big question. How do you think that the nuclear power industry will be affected by this crisis? And given what we're seeing unfolding, do you think there is anything that can really be labeled as a safe nuclear reactor at this point?
That's what we call it in the United States. As you know, it's a $65 million or $65,000 question. I think nuclear industry globally will be affected very strongly. In fact, I wrote in an article in 1989, and it has been used this term a lot, and you most probably have heard that a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. I put that in an article in 1989 because what I saw happening in Chernobyl. And when I visited Chernobyl reactor number 3, and the exclusion zone where I was there for 3 days in the control room of reactor number 3 at that time was operational in 1987, I saw it for myself. What does it mean? And when I met people from the country of Belarusia, that 20% of its GNP is spent on Chernobyl-related damage control, that really brought me to my senses. A nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. I think the global nuclear power industry will suffer as a result of Fukushima. And most probably the way it will suffer is it will hamper the growth of the nuclear power industry in some countries, or the projected growth. However, the issue of nuclear power is really, it's a more fundamental, it's an energy reality. One of my colleagues once reminded me of a quote from General Charles de Gaulle, the former French president. He said the only reason that France has decided to go for nuclear power is France doesn't have oil, France doesn't have gas, and France doesn't have any option. Something along that line. The quote was much more eloquent, the way that I paraphrased that. When you don't have any option, like Japan, you are forced to go to nuclear. And again, this is an inevitable reality. But I think we have to go on and learn lessons and try to improve our lessons. One thing that I personally learned a lesson from Fukushima disaster is really we need to rethink and go back to review and re-examine some of the assumptions that I myself as engineer and the courses that I teach on probabilistic safety assessment and risk assessment that we do. Some of our assumptions needs to be revisited. And in fact, the quotes that I've been always using in, maybe that's a good finale or ending point for our conversation. There is a quote that I've been always sharing with my USC students. After what I saw in Chernobyl, after what I saw in Bhopal chemical accident, and after what I saw because I'm involved in the BP Deepwater Horizon accident investigation also. After I saw in the case of this complex systems failure, and now if you add Fukushima to that, a quote from Aristotle that I share with my students. And this is a very, very beautiful, very, very powerful quote. And this is something I want to end up with that. And I hope that you and your listeners will note the quote from Aristotle. Aristotle said, quote, probable impossibilities are to be preferred to improbable possibilities. I repeat again, quote, probable impossibilities are to be preferred to improbable possibilities. What we are facing in Fukushima is really the probable impossibilities that should be the basis for our new thinking. We should think out of the box. We need to have a paradigm shift. If we can design our systems to take into account probable impossibilities, I think we may end up with having safe nuclear power plants. But what we have been doing so far, we have been concentrating on improbable possibilities.
Well, some very sobering words during this crisis. Dr. Mishkati, just before we finish, are there any books or websites you'd like to recommend for people who are interested in what's happening at Fukushima or about nuclear safety in general?
I think I will ask your listeners, and first of all, please extend, and I would like to extend my deep condolences for the loss of life in Japan. Really, this is heart-wrenching for me as a human being. And also for what the people in nearby Fukushima is going through. This is not their fault. And again, it's a natural disaster, and it had a secondary effect of the man-made disaster. Again, my heartfelt condolences to my Japanese friends and fellow human beings. I personally would like to recommend my Japanese friends and your listeners to look and always follow New York Times website. New York Times has a beautiful, great website maintained by one of its best reporters, who is a walking directory of nuclear safety, Matthew Wald, and some other contributing writers. New York Times website is one of the most useful sources, I would say, for what's happening in Fukushima. There is also another organization that you can log into them and get daily press release from them. And I've been using them for last many years. They are called World Nuclear News. World Nuclear News. And World Nuclear News is a very, very good website, and I really trust them a lot. These are not commercial entities. These are not trying to push a product or something. And they, before even this crisis, they had the most accurate news about the global nuclear power development, safety news, technology development news, and that World Nuclear News. And the last but not least website, I would urge your listeners and blog reviewers to look into the website that I developed with my students on Tokaimura. Again, I have to admit that we have not updated that website since 1999. But it's still the material that we have on that website is very important and very, very critical. And then, of course, I have a website myself on Chernobyl, which I put some of my student paper. There are some links over there, and I posted some of my papers, including my 1993 testimony about improving the IAEA and that.
Excellent.
I can
yes.
email you this website, at least two or three links that you may like to post that on your website, sir.
Absolutely. I will certainly accept those links gratefully, and I will post them with this interview, so they'll be right there for people to access as they're listening to this interview. Dr. Mashkati, I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today, and I certainly hope that we can talk to you again in the future as things develop.
By all means, my heart and prayers are with my Japanese friends and fellow citizens.